Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello, I'm David Baddiel.
And I'm Saeeda Farsi.
And welcome to A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
And today we're going to be talking about fasting. The month of Ramadan has started, and also how it's impacting on Muslims because of what is happening in Rafah.
But before we get there, on a possibly lighter note, although some serious stuff went down there, we're going to talk about the Oscars and a few things about the Oscars, particularly about Jewish representation and how Jews are cast and how their stories are told in films. But I guess before we get to that wider subject, we should probably address something which is very immediate, which is Jonathan Glazer, the director of the film The Zone of Interest, which is a film about Auschwitz. He won for Best International Film. And in his speech, he was, I think, the only person actually on stage while receiving an award to mention the conflict. He came on stage with two other men, James Wilson, who's a producer, and Len Blavatnik, who is a producer. And he read out something from a bit of paper, which he clearly wanted to get right. But he talked about how the film is not just about the past, it's also about the present, where we are right now. And then the bit that caused a lot of trouble is he said, right now, we, that's the three men there, stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. There is then applause. Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all the victims of this dehumanization, how do we resist? And then there was more applause. And then he ended up dedicating the film and this award to someone who was a member of the resistance that is portrayed in the film. So what's caused a lot of fuss is, to be honest, he's saying a complex thing. And he's saying it at an awards ceremony, which is basically a piece of fluff. And certainly now in the days of social media, can't really sustain this level of complexity. So
push back on that, David? Can I say that awards ceremonies are huge platforms? And so in many ways are the perfect place to be able to put out a big message. And I think when I watched that moment at the Oscars, the fact that he took out a piece of paper, which meant he had thought about what he was going to say, the fact he'd written these words out in long form and read them. And I think for me, the fact that his hands were shaking, you could tell he was really moved and very emotional at that moment. So do you not think that was the right moment for him to be saying these things?
I don't think it's the right or wrong moment for it. My point is really about complexity and about the fact that the speech has been deeply misinterpreted. And I think that is to do with the fact that complex thoughts are quite difficult to express in an award ceremony speech. And the central thing that's been misunderstood is him using the phrase refute. We stand here as men who refute their Jewishness. That has been perhaps willfully, perhaps just because people are a bit stupid, misunderstood by quite a lot of Jews on social media as him somehow or other handing in his Jewish cards in response to what's happening in Israel, Gaza. He's not doing that. So just to explain what he was saying, when it's a long sentence, and he says, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked. So it takes him a while to get to the verb, and that's the important verb, being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Now, there's a lot going on there, but the central point is he is not saying I do not want to be a Jew anymore because of what's happening in Israel. He is saying that he feels that there is a version of Jewishness and perhaps a version of the Holocaust that is used by the Israeli government to sustain their justification for what's happening in a wider sense in their control of Gaza and the West Bank. It's a very complex thing. That weaponization of the Holocaust by the Israelis is one of their planks through which they feel that they can justify their behaviour. So that's what he was saying. And that is itself quite a sort of complicated and, for a lot of Jews, extreme thing to say.
I'm going to ask you this question, David. When you listen to that, how did it immediately make you feel?
Well, that's a good question, because initially I felt that I didn't quite understand it. And my wife, who is not Jewish or Muslim, said, what did that mean? And she's a very clever woman, but I still thought I had to understand it. And then I realised, OK, that's what he's saying. He's taking the position, which is quite common amongst left-wing Jews, which is that they want to separate their own Jewishness from the actions of the Israeli government. That is really what he's saying. And slightly more complicated, which is, as a filmmaker making a film about the Holocaust, he wants to separate his sense of how to remember the Holocaust and what it means from anything the Israeli government might be doing. How did it make me feel? It made me feel instantly worried, because I thought instantly loads of people will misunderstand this, will misrepresent it, and will weaponize it on either side, is what I thought. Tell me how it made you feel.
For me, when I watched it and I listened to it, I just felt a huge sense of relief. I felt that finally somebody who was in a position of power and authority and had a huge platform and was Jewish was talking about trying to understand the horrors of today. And what I interpreted it as, and, you know, this is why this podcast is so important, because it allows us to explore how people see things in a different way, depending on which perspective they come from. I thought what he was saying was that let's remember the horrors of the past, but let's also see how they relate to the horrors of now, and that human suffering within sight, sound and smell, which is what the movie was about, that this was an ordinary family carrying on their ordinary life. And yet, you know, Auschwitz was next door and this appalling human catastrophe was unfolding. But yet the normalness of their life was juxtaposed against that. And I think what he was saying was, how do we relate it to what's happening in Gaza today?
Well, I think that's true in general of the film. The film is about the ability of human beings to stand by while horror is going on. I think the speech was more pointed than that. And this is why it has led to a lot of reaction. And indeed, some people who have completely understood it are still very upset because of a sense that what that leads to is a belief that what the Israeli government is doing is similar to what the Nazis were doing. And that's something which is so complicated because weaponization of the Holocaust happens, therefore, on both sides. On both sides, you've got this sense in which, oh, the Israeli government are using the Shoah to sort of say Jews are always vulnerable, Jews are always acting in self-defense, Hamas are the Nazis. And then on the other side, left-wing people, including Jonathan Glazer, are sort of saying that, you know, what the Israeli government is doing is allowing the same kind of horrors to go on whilst normalizing life on the other side of their wall. What I think is that what happens all the time is that something which is a very specific thing, which is the Holocaust, which has a very specific historical character, gets just swung about in these conversations. It was brave of him to raise it. And as a Jewish man, a Jewish director, I think, you know, it's very complicated for him to do that. I will push back a little bit. I noticed a few people saying that it was brave in a wider context. So I think it was emotionally brave of him, psychologically brave of him. I don't think it's particularly sort of socio-politically brave, if you see what I mean. I saw people saying, you know, oh, this means Jonathan Glazer's career is over. It doesn't. He's already been praised by Time magazine. There's a huge swathe of people who will think it's great that he said that. But I can promise you, it does not mean in the Jewish tropes of power thing that now, because he said this, Jonathan Glazer's career is over and he will be shut down. That is not true.
I've been watching some of the response to Jonathan's speech and some of the vitriol and aggression, actually, that he's had online from quite senior members of the Jewish community, people who you would consider to be, I think, part of the sane squad, has been really quite concerning. And I'll tell you why. Because for me, I think what has been missing in the last 6 months, and certainly I've seen it missing within British kind of politics and society, is what I consider to be the institutionalized British Jewish community and its lack of outspokenness on what is happening in Gaza. So if you take, you know, the kind of main institutions like the Board of Deputies or the Jewish Leadership Council or even the Chief Rabbi's office, I've been quite concerned at the lack of statements that have come from them, which I feel show a level of understanding which goes beyond just tribalism. And I've spoken about that with Jewish friends and colleagues. And I think the diversity of Jewish opinion has not been reflected in the public space. And I felt that with Jonathan's speech, this was a moment where a different view, a view that I've heard over and over again from Jewish friends and colleagues, the diversity of Jewish opinion on what's going on in Israel and Gaza was heard. And that's so important. It's important for Jewish people, and it's also important for people who see themselves aligned with the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree, as ever, that the diversity of opinion should be shown. And there are many Jews who feel that. I think it is based to some extent on a category error, which is the notion that Jewishness itself is dependent on the behaviour of the Israeli government. And I think some people like Jonathan Glazer or, say, Judith Butler, who's Jewish, who recently got a lot of applause for describing Hamas as a resistance movement, they said recently they get so appalled by the actions of the Israeli government and they feel that as Jews they so need to distance themselves from it that they say something which I think some Jews will think is too extreme. But I agree with you that the range of opinion is very multifarious in the Jewish community about this, and sometimes it can feel that it isn't, certainly from the institutions. You're right.
I think for Jonathan, because he is Jewish, it gives him a different privilege to be able to talk about it in that way. But I think something has happened this time round, you know, David. This particular conflict in Gaza, the particular way in which this has been operationally handled by Netanyahu. I think the fact that we have got such an extreme right-wing extremist government in place in Israel and the way in which it's handled this has probably been in a way that no other government, I think, would have handled it. And I think that's where probably this time these connotations and these references have been made. And also because consistently the Palestinians are referred to as the Nazis. You can't bring that terminology and that point of history
conflict. I'm going to push back on that. Who does that? Hamas, you mean?
You see this.
Who does that?
So, for example, when the Israeli minister Smotrich compared the Gazans to Nazis, or the minister Nir Berkat said that what Hamas is doing is worse than what the Nazis did. And I think, well, you can't draw Second World War Nazi terminology to this conflict and then be surprised that that terminology is then not used in reverse.
Okay, so as far as I'm aware, that would be a specific reference to the Hamas charter that insists on the genocide of all Jews, which initially it did. I think it's been changed now. And if that is correct, then that is not a, you know, inadequate or useless analogy if that is what is in their charter, because that would be the modus operandi of the Nazi party. But to call all Palestinians Nazis is obviously completely ridiculous. And you're right, if that is happening, then, you know, you can't then complain when it happens the other way around. You know, I agree with the basic point that that Nazi comparisons in almost any situation anyway are not helpful. But I am worried a little bit, you know, with my radar for what most Jews think, that just as there are people on the Israeli side of things who are calling for, you know, a type of ethnic cleansing, there clearly are people on the Hamas side that have been calling for that for Jews for ages.
I can agree with that. I think that, David, you and I can agree with the fact that there are people on both sides of this dispute who would want the other one to be completely eliminated from those lands. You know, there are people within Hamas who wouldn't want an Israeli state, and there are people within the top of Israeli politics right now who don't want a Palestinian state. But I think the vast majority in the middle hopefully want coexistence. And I think it's really important to focus on the opinions of those people.
So there's another issue for Jews going on at the Oscars, which is that there were three films in contention, only two of them for major awards, in which Jewish characters are being portrayed by non-Jews. That's Maestro, which is about Leonard Bernstein with Bradley Cooper, obviously Oppenheimer with Cillian Murphy, and also Golder about Golda Meir with Helen Mirren. Two of those, Bradley Cooper's film Maestro and Golder, were up for nominations for makeup because they involved using prosthetics, most famously in Maestro, a larger nose, to make the non-Jewish actor look more like the Jewish character. Now, I've talked about this a lot elsewhere, the issue of authenticity casting. I'll very quickly run through it again. My issue is very little, really, to do with acting in and of itself, because sometimes if I talk about this, people say, oh, actors should be allowed to act. What's wrong with you? And my point is, well, they're not in every other case since, I don't know, about 20 years ago, gradually building. It's become more and more of a monitored thing within acting, within casting, that authenticity casting rules the roost, meaning that you have to cast any minority, and this isn't just ethnic minority, this would include, you know, deaf people in Coda, or when autistic characters are being cast now, that any minority has to be cast more or less along the lines of, you know, the character has to be the same as the actor. That isn't the case with Jews. We can talk about how much it is or isn't the case with Muslims, but I think there may be other issues there as well. But certainly with these big films and many other examples, most of the time it's not required to have a Jewish actor. And the issue, as I say, is not really to do with acting. It's to do with the fact that I believe that the reason that a deaf actor is now playing a deaf part is that it's considered to be disrespectful to the deaf community to have someone who hasn't had the lived experience of that life to be mimicking that on screen. And the actress in Coda said, deaf is not a costume, which is very interesting because actors wear costume. But whether or not it's correct, and I think that's a whole other argument, the fact is it exists. This stricture exists in show business now, and Jews are not part of it. And so the point is that if the essential idea is that some vulnerable minorities, or minorities in general, their lived experience needs to be respected in such a way that only someone who has actually lived that experience can play them, then why is that respect not offered to Jews? That's the point.
That's the point that you make in your book and in the documentary Jews Don't Count, that this concept of having to Jew face actors up to make them look like Jews and play these roles when actually you could have just cast Jewish people in those roles. Is that correct, or have I not understood that?
No, more or less correct. I mean, actually, Jew face as an idea does not require a big nose, or in the case of Golda Meir, all the other prosthetics or whatever. That, as it happens, that is literal Jew face. They have change the actor's face to make them look more apparently Jewish. But actually, it's a general term that just means that an actor is playing a Jew when they themselves are not Jewish.
So here's a question that I want to raise, because I would come back at you on that and say that is what I would call, in my parenting with my kids, a first world problem. And I'll tell you why. Because if you look at this from a Muslim perspective, when these characters are being played, whether it was Maestro or whether it was Oppenheimer, these were very positive Jewish characters being played by non-Jewish actors. The biggest challenge for Muslims at the moment in Hollywood or broader in cinema is that it's very rare even to see a positive Muslim character, never mind it being played by Muslims, that often it will be a terrorist, or it will be somebody who's a misogynist, or it will be somebody who perpetuates kind of stereotypes about Muslim communities. So Riz Ahmed, this amazing British actor now working in Hollywood, spoke about this when he basically said that the system, as far as Muslims are concerned, is messed up and rigged. Because what he basically says is either Muslims are invisible or they're depicted as the bad guys and they're villainized. And long before we even get into a debate about whether or not Muslim actors should be playing Muslim roles, we need to start having Muslims depicted in a positive way. And I'm going to talk to you about this because, you know, often we talk about the way in which outsiders depict Muslims and Jews. But I want to talk to you about how Jews have depicted Muslims, and particularly in the Borat films. I watched them, and obviously Sacha Baron Cohen is Jewish, the writers were Jewish, and I felt that the depiction of a Muslim character
I'm going to have to stop you there, sorry. Sacha is absolutely insistent that the character is not a Muslim, and there's a bit in it where his religion is discussed and he says, I follow the hawk.
I think it's important, David, to talk about the fact that this character is depicted as being from Kazakhstan, which is a overwhelming majority Muslim country. He wears a ring which says Allah on it, and you can clearly see the inscription of Allah on it in Arabic.
Okay, so I'm going to have to stop you again, but I've had a long conversation with Sacha about this. That's one photograph where he said he was given a ring for a thing in France and he didn't even look at the ring, and he's really, really angry and upset that he wore it, and that caused him a lot of danger as well. I'm sorry, but I I'm a close friend of Sacha Baron Cohen, and all I can tell you is he is very insistent the character is not Muslim.
Okay, can I explain to you why I think he is, right? Okay. So even though he may insist that the character is not Muslim, the way in which that character is depicted as somebody with multiple wives, somebody who's misogynistic, somebody who's anti-Semitic, somebody who wears a ring with the word Allah on it, somebody who comes from Kazakhstan, everything about the way he projects, if you put that in front of any reasonable person, they would come away with thinking, oh, he's depicting a Muslim character. And it's not a one-off, is it, with him? He then played the dictator, all the Ali G stuff. And, you know, Ali G is like so obviously a Muslim reference. You know, all of these things were very reflective of Muslim stereotyping, Muslim stigmatizing. If a Muslim, if Riz suddenly decided to play a character with a big nose and he kept going on about power and this really big media mogul and he came from Israel or New York or whatever, you know, we would say, I'm sorry, but you're depicting stereotypes about Jewish characters. But the fact that he hasn't addressed it in any way, in the end, we have to address our demons when we get the issue of equality wrong. You've had to address it with blackface. I've had to address it with homophobia. And I think Sasha has to address it in relation to his character, Borat.
But I do know that the character was never meant to be a parody of a Muslim. He's just a classical clown in lots of ways. Possibly the dictator is, but then also he's a dictator. You know, he's meant to be a mad dictator, of which there are many, you know, including Saddam Hussein and all the rest of it. And, you know, I'm trying to talk about Jewish exclusion from authenticity casting, and I feel we haven't discussed that. Firstly, in terms of the first world thing, it's not really a first world thing, I think. If you actually watch those films, Maestro and Oppenheimer, there's a sort of huge erasure of those characters' Jewishness. Yes, I agree with you that they are given the privilege of having films made about them and they are Jewish, but their Jewishness is massively, like, not part of the story. In Oppenheimer, which is the biggest film of the year, it's mentioned once or twice, but in fact, the character has had to suffer, Julius Oppenheimer himself. He didn't use the word Julius because he was too frightened that might make people think he was Jewish, had to suffer all sorts of anti-Semitism. He himself tried to assimilate in order to get over it. That is not part of the film. It's not part of the film that the Manhattan Project itself, the discovery of the atomic bomb, was mainly staffed with Jewish physicists, all terrified that the Nazis were going to win the war. It's not telling the story. It's not telling the Jewish story. The most iconic member, I would say, of our minority, Albert Einstein, is in that film, played by Tom Conti, who is not Jewish. If it was another minority, that would be just an enormous outcry. And this is my point. It's my point. It's not really just about the idea of Jew face or whatever. It's so deeply monitored, this, with other minorities, especially with the playing of iconic people. There was a film about Nina Simone in 2016, which was basically didn't do very well because Zoe Saldana, who was considered not black enough to play Nina Simone, played that part, and the film was essentially brought down with arguments about colorism. And
I tell you what, I do agree with you on both on Oppenheimer and on Maestro. I just felt that their Jewishness and the impact of their Jewishness on who they were as individuals simply wasn't heard. And yeah, I want to, everything that you've just said about, you know, Einstein, about the Jewish physicists, all of those were really complex. They were the why of what they were doing. Because in the movie, we saw a lot of what they were doing, but I think the why of what they were doing was related to their Jewishness. And I would have loved to have seen that. But let me talk to you about another movie, American Sniper. If you look at the appalling depiction of Muslims in that, the way in which it enabled hate crimes, the way in which it enabled a view about Muslim communities, how divisive it was, the kind of always being the bad guys. And this is done over and over again in Hollywood. So I think the reason why I say I hear you and I hear the concern that you have about the way in which Jews are not playing full-fledged Jewish characters in these movies, for Muslim communities, and this has been going on for decades, going back to, you know, Black Hawk Down, going back to some of those early movies in the way in which Arabs and Muslims are always depicted as these kind of angry, marauding terrorists. And it happens year after year after year.
I think the issue of representation either way is important. Whether or not I think, by the way, you're completely right that there are not enough films about Muslims that really tell the truth about who Muslims are, that show the full humanity of Muslims. That is completely true. There's something else going on, which is similar but different in the way that Jewish representation is being changed and erased. So what you're getting are still these stories about these men, Leonard Bernstein or Oppenheimer, or in the case of Golda Meir, a woman who are important and they're seen as historically important, but somehow or other their Jewishness isn't very important. I mean, Leonard Bernstein, his whole thing was being, how can I make my music more Jewish? And how can I use Jewish folk tradition into classical music? And how can I make West Side Story a story that uses modern New York, but still tells Romeo and Juliet, but still has that sort of Jewish element to it? But all of this is not in Maestro. There's a tiny scene where he mentions his Jewishness once as exposition, and that's it. But I think it's the same thing in a different way. Yeah, I agree with you.
No, but I think it's completely different. So I think with those, these are positive characters that are not fully portrayed in all their complexities. Whereas when it comes to Muslim communities, I think it is movies are specifically manipulated and they have these underlying coded messages in them, which is all about these are the bad, nasty, crazy people.
I agree with you that representation of Muslims still has a long way to go, but you are also, of course, a person of colour, and I guess that's where, although there's still lots of ways to go with that, but there has been attempts by Hollywood and BBC and others to really improve on the way that people of colour are represented and in terms of the authenticity of that. And that's where I think Jews are left out of that. That's the standard by which I would say Jews are left out. Shall we move on to what
Sugar,
you told?
I have just drunk water and I'm supposed to be fasting.
Oh, I think you'll be okay.
You can tell how stressed I am. I have just drank water.
I didn't know that you couldn't have water, because that seems very strict to me. I don't know anything, and I throw myself at your mercy here, Saida, about Ramadan, really. I've obviously heard it many times discussed, and I've heard people say Eid Mubarak, but I don't know really what kind of festival it is, and particularly how it plays into what's happening in Gaza. So perhaps you can help me on.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Yeah, so Ramadan has started. So in terms of all the optimism about having a permanent ceasefire before Ramadan, it tragically hasn't happened. So Ramadan is the month of fasting and it marks the moment when the Quran was revealed. And it's 30 days of fasting and every day you fast between sunrise and sunset and you get up in the morning, have a small meal, which is known as suhoor. And then in the evening, you break your fast with another meal, which is known as iftar.
So Jews fast on Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement. It's only one day. It's not a month. And I think you're allowed to drink water, although I haven't fasted on Yom Kippur for so long, I'm not sure. So that just seems really
strict. This is bad, David.
As you know, I'm not a religious Jew, although I did used to fast on Yom Kippur when I was a kid, and that was really difficult because when I was a kid, I just wanted custard and sweets all the time, so it was really hard for me. And occasionally, my older brother still fasts on Yom Kippur and makes me feel bad because I should just probably do it for my health. But it starts at sunrise and ends at sunset.
There's no food and no drink during that period. And it does have huge health benefits. I don't know if you've heard of the 5-2 diet.
Oh, I've tried it, trust me.
Well, okay. Well, the origins of the 5-2 diet were actually from prophetic times. And there's been all sorts of proven health benefits from lowering your blood sugar to better gut health, to managing blood pressure, to all sorts of things by having your gut empty for a period of time and fasting for certain times during the week. But it's also what, you know, this time, this particular Ramadan, it's what makes it so poignant with what's going on in Gaza, David, because normally at this time of the year, you'd bring people together, lots of community spirit, lots of opening up doors and asking people to come in and share food. And at the moment, the British Muslim community, people that I'm speaking to, just feel like they're going through collective trauma, that when they're waking up to have this morning meal, they're thinking of Gaza, when they're going to bed at night or, you know, when they're having the evening meal, they're thinking about Gaza, that they can't even enjoy that moment of collective coming together because
can I
the situation out there is so dire.
Sorry, that's what I wanted to focus on in a way, is the collectiveness that you're talking about. Like during Ramadan, is there a sense, I mean, I'm sure, and I get a strong sense of this, that Muslims often think about other Muslims anyway and about the whole community, but during Ramadan, there's a stronger sense of that, that one should be thinking about how Muslims are doing all over the world, and therefore what's happening in Gaza makes that very sad and difficult?
I think what it does is, so it's not just your responsibility to other Muslims, it's your responsibility to making sure that people around you are looked after. And because there is a huge amount of giving, so this concept of giving 2.5% of your wealth to charity, which is known as zakat, which is one of the pillars of your faith, is something that happens in Ramadan. So if you look at the United Kingdom, for example, David, there are 4 million Muslims in the United Kingdom and on average, they raise over £150 million just in the month of Ramadan. And that's the level of giving. And this year, it's all about Gaza, because this is a population which, by every account, whether it's the UN or even our own assessment, is on the verge of famine. These are children who are dying of starvation. These are a population where food is within, you know, yards of where they are, and we can't get it through. And the question that I want to ask, David, and, you know, if it's unfair, just push back, but I always think, what are the conversations happening in Jewish homes right now when they're watching these pictures? You know, let's put the war to one side, but just the human suffering, because I know that, you know, I know from speaking to Muslim friends and others, you know, there's complete trauma at watching these pictures of these children particularly just wasting away.
The answer to that question is that what I'm aware of is that Jewish families are absolutely totally appalled by it, very upset by it, very much don't want it to be happening. You know, even the most pro-Israeli Jews, as far as I'm aware, just look at those pictures and feel that situation to be appalling and awful and feel desperately sad for it, I guess. And again, you know, I haven't said this that much on this podcast, but what's weird about this podcast for me is that I spent years whilst talking about Jews saying, don't ask me about Israel. Don't make my conversation about anti-Semitism that I'm having to be all about Israel. I kind of don't give a fuck about Israel. I sort of don't give a fuck about the whole situation there, which would be true, actually, until the present moment where I think I, too, have been sort of emotionally overwhelmed by the whole thing. But generally, I would push back against the tendency, very much on the part of progressives, to make Jewishness and anti-Semitism and the whole issue to be all about Israel, that really this centuries-old racism, they would reduce it to what's happening in the Middle East. Having said all that, I'm now on this podcast. I'm in a position where I am talking about it more. And my thinking is, everyone wants this to stop. Jews want it to stop. Obviously, Muslims want it to stop. And by the way, if there are any listening, Christians and other people want it to stop. It's horrible and awful. I guess that there are a fair amount of people in the Jewish community who think, well, the way to make it stop is obviously for Israel to stop the war, and for Hamas, who are still there in tunnels underneath Rafah, to also lay down their arms, to release the hostages, and to present some kind of negotiated non-military settlement to the situation. And I suppose the feeling is, in order for it to stop, in order for those people to be fed, there has to be a negotiated settlement. So how does that happen when Hamas, as much as the Israelis refuse, it seems to me, to come to that position?
I think, look, in the end, you know, we know that this will only come to an end when the occupation comes to an end. Until there are two states, two viable, secure states next to each other, we will continue to have bouts of violence, because
I
cannot continue to subjugate peoples and expect them to live like that, you know, generation after generation. I think what I'm thinking about right now, and you know, if it's, again, I'm happy for you to push back, but what goes through my mind, and lots of Muslims ask me this question, and they say, you know, do Jewish people, when they sit there and watch these pictures of literally a community under siege, now being starved, not having the basics, 70% of them drinking contaminated water, little babies now dying because their mothers can't feed them, food being literally there on the border and not being allowed in day after day after day. And we only have to look at the truck figures. The number of trucks going in last month have been halved this month. So this is a very deliberate strategy by the current Israeli government. The fact that its allies are having to resort to throwing food out of the air and now thinking about building a the port just to try and get food into these starving, innocent people. What goes through the mind of, say, a British Jewish person?
Well, you know, we started this podcast by talking about Jonathan Glazer calling out the occupation. So firstly, let's not characterise Jewish families as one whole who all think the same thing, who are all somehow ignoring this or, you know, pushing it aside or whatever. We just had a Jewish person call out specifically the occupation and the innocent victims of it on, a, as you said, a very large platform.
But
I think it's problematic to the rhetoric of saying, "Oh, Muslims say to me, what are Jewish people thinking?" implies, I think, a callousness, which is not there. Jewish people are, firstly, very diverse about it, and some of them are involved in trying to help in various different ways, and some of them, obviously, are going on marches calling for an end to what's happening, and many of them are calling for an end to the occupation in general. So there's a huge diversity of opinion, first of all, but on the sort of mainstream side of it, all I can tell you is I think most Jews feel terrible about it, but think we don't know how to stop it. And you haven't answered this to push back on it because you went back to the wider thing of the occupation and the two-state solution. But in the moment, how do we stop this immediate problem? And how do we feed these people? And how do we stop the awful things that are happening when there seems to be a resistance to, and I'm sure that you'll say there's a resistance on the Israeli side as well, which I acknowledge, but a resistance to releasing the hostages, to calling for a peaceful settlement, to not calling for any more October the 7th from Hamas.
I'm going to disagree with you on that, David, because Hamas have said they will release all the hostages. Hamas have said that they will do that as part of a negotiated settlement where children and women and other prisoners that are in Israeli jails, many of them who have never been tried, so it's just arbitrary detention until they have been released. And what Hamas and Israel are refusing to agree on is a permanent ceasefire. The reason we're at this crossroads is because what Hamas is saying is that we want this violence to end on both sides. We will release the hostages on both sides, and that we will then move towards a political solution. And what Israel is saying is we will cease fire for a short period of time. We will then release these hostages, but then we can't guarantee that we're not going to go into Rafah thereafter, and we're not going to carry on moving our troops into Gaza and then remain in Gaza.
So just to be clear about what you're saying here, you're saying essentially that you think that what Hamas say there is completely trustworthy, that that is what they want.
This is what's being reported.
I know, but you just said Hamas are asking for this. They're asking for release of prisoners in detention and then for a permanent ceasefire, which is what most Jews want. I agree that it might be not what Netanyahu wants, but most Jews definitely want that. But most Jews would also not trust Hamas. Right. Mm-hmm. They would not trust them, and they would not believe, certainly not when, you know, a lot of them live in Qatar and do not live in Gaza, that they would not necessarily think that Hamas saying all we want is a permanent ceasefire and the Israelis won't agree to our demands to let prisoners out is necessarily trustworthy.
Let me make a few things clear. One, I do not think Hamas is part of the solution. And I do not think that a future Palestinian state is going to be governed by Hamas, nor should it ever be governed by Hamas. That's my first view. Secondly, I do not think that Netanyahu and these far-right extremists are part of the solution. And I do not think that a future Israeli state should be governed by these far-right extremist settlers and Netanyahu and self-confessed fascists. So for me, I'm clear. I don't trust Hamas and I don't trust Netanyahu. And I'm not the least bit surprised that they don't trust each other.
Quite clearly, they're both a problem. So when you're asking me what do Jewish families think, which I'm going to take, you may not mean it like that, but there's a tight sense of like, why aren't they more worried about it? Why aren't they doing more, whatever? I think there's a feeling of, well, it feels like there's these two intractable, very bad bodies, as it were, operating, destroying the lives of many people. The answer, what's the answer? And the answer is very difficult.
So when there is ever anything that is done in the name of Islam around the world, which is horrific and violent and unacceptable, what I sit there and think about is, one, this is awful and horrific and violent. And secondly, this shapes the world's opinion about Islam and Muslims.
Right.
But if I was a Jewish person, and this is why I asked you this question, I would be thinking this awful, horrific humanitarian catastrophe is unfolding before our eyes on a daily basis, where a population is being starved and is on the verge of famine. One, that's appalling, and I completely understand you will be sat there thinking like me, this is appalling. But secondly, this will have an impact for decades and generations about the way Israel and Jewish people are seen. There's that blowback that happens with Muslims and Islam. There's that blowback that will happen with
Indeed.
Jews and Judaism. And I just think that I'm not hearing those voices in mainstream British Jewry who are saying, this is appalling and does not need to be done in our name. And I need to hear that from people with authority.
Right, OK. So that's the point, is in our name. You see, I reject that anyway. I reject the notion that, you know, things that happen in Israel, and this comes back to Jonathan Glazer's point, because they do weaponise that. They do have a sense that they're acting on behalf of Jews in general. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the only way that Jews can be seen as a proper minority is if they're not continually associated with the actions of a state that is not the state that they are part of for most Jews around the world. So, but I agree with you. I know that that happens. I know that it happens to Muslims, that they are associated with terrible things that are not where they live, not part of their culture, but they're still supposed to answer for it in some ways. And it seems to be happening at the moment to Jews in a very extreme way, that, you know, all Jews are being, as it were, tarred with the same brush. And I wonder if Israelis, especially the government, but Israelis in general, how much they are aware of the impact of the actions of the Israeli government on Jews around the world, that the diaspora is massively impacted here in a way that should not happen. It's a dysfunctional thing, but it's happening. Israelis don't quite feel, and certainly the Israeli government, don't quite feel the damage that they're doing to Jews around the world.
I think what's happened in this particular conflict more than others is that there's been almost united, singular views coming out of what I call the institutionalized British Jewish community. So last week we had a really positive meeting between senior Muslims and senior Jews, not what I would call the institutionalized British Jewish community. And the diversity of opinion and feeling was so important for both sides to hear each other and to actually feel the pain from each other as well. And I think more of that needs to be done. And part of what we're doing in this podcast is saying there is a diversity of opinion within our communities. We have our own personal opinions, but we try on this podcast to try and reflect that diversity of opinions within our communities, so that we're not seen as binary either by each other or by the broader British communities.
Coming back to Ramadan just for a second. So, sorry, I'm gonna bring it down to food. Do you have a really big meal every day then at the end? Iftar, right?
Yeah, some people do. And that's where they go horribly wrong. So the whole point of Ramadan is not to feast at the end of the day. The whole point is just to have quite small meals and to think about those less fortunate than themselves and to be really grateful for what you're given. Whereas actually these huge Ramadan parties, iftar parties, normally take place. Actually, interestingly, this year, not so. Again, I think because of what's going on in Gaza, it's been very subdued. And I think there's going to be a lot more giving. I think this is going to be a record year for charitable giving within Muslim communities.
So I did the 5-2 diet for a bit.
Are you going to do a fast with me? I want you to do Ramadan.
I'm going to do it, but first I have to tell you, and you need to be aware of this, I got so angry when I was doing the 5-2 diet on the 2 days. If I do, which you've suggested, come up to your house in Wakefield and fast on the way, I might be in a bad mood. That's all I'm saying.
But you see, part of Ramadan and part of fasting is to control all your other bad habits. So I'm trying really hard not to curse. You'll have noticed I haven't cursed at all today. And I try not to get angry. And every morning I wake up to some headline and I'm like, nope, it's Ramadan. Calm down. Deep breath. Try and find nice ways to get through this day. So part of Ramadan is also about trying to be the best possible version of yourself, which isn't always easy.
I can help you there because I think you should be a good Muslim and you should be the best version of yourself on Ramadan. But I'm going to say on your behalf, a big fuck off to those Tories who have said horrible things about Diane Abbott and indeed various other things. Is that helpful for you?
Say it again.
fuck off.
I feel better now. And you know, if God, whichever God is looking down, I didn't do that. David did. I get the heaven points and he gets the naughty points for this. Yeah.
He's a Jew. He'll be fine.
Oh, no.
I've said that now. Yeah.
So I know we always teach other a word, and I felt that bits of today's conversation, we did go there, and they were difficult. So I want to teach you the word for difficult, which is mushkil.
Mushkil. Okay. I don't know if you'll want to say this, but Yiddish has a lot of words for penis. And the reason I bring it up is that that might be how you're thinking about some of your
Ramadan.
Colleagues. Obviously, you can't say it.
You know why I can't say that word? Because one of the other things that you can't do in Ramadan between sunrise and sunset is make love. So therefore,
really?
We're not talking about that. We're not thinking about that.
Okay, because there's so many words, schmuck, schlong, schmeckle, Petzl, Putz. I mean, it's incredible. It's like that's all they thought about in the shtetls. All right, I'll tell you what. I'll use the word kvetch, which is quite a famous word, but it basically means complain, which is something you want to do at the moment to your colleagues, but you're choosing not to.
Kvetch.
So kvetch, yeah. Kvetch. You did it well. By the way, if any of you listening have any questions, anything you think we should be talking about, please let us know. The email is podcast@instinctproductions.com. That's podcast@instinctproductions.com. Just let us know.
Looking forward to your fasting and looking forward to doing iftar with you.
Muslim and a Jew Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.